Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Naked Genetics Podcast, taking a look inside your genes.
It's the hottest new biotechnology technique to hit the headlines since, well, since ever. CRISPR is a precision set of genome editing tools, enabling scientists to cut and paste together DNA in any organism exactly how they want. And the implications for human health and even humanity are huge.
What you end up with is, in effect, this sequence that you've added, precisely inserted in the targeted position in the genome.
Plus, linking genetics to lifestyle, and our gene of the month is black and white and very cute. This is the Naked Genetics Podcast for February 2016 with me, Dr. Kat Arney, brought to you in association with the Genetics Society, online at genetics.org.uk. The speed at which CRISPR has moved from the pages of dry academic journals to the headlines of newspapers, not to mention labs and biotech companies around the world, has been breathtaking. This month, the UK Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority granted a licence for scientists at the Francis Crick Institute in London to start using the technique to modify early-stage human embryos, although these wouldn't be allowed to grow past the stage of being a tiny ball of cells. Although it might seem like the CRISPR story has come out of nowhere in the past year, the Naked Genetics podcast was on the case back in 2012, when University of California, Berkeley researcher Jennifer Doudna and her collaborator Emmanuel Charpentier, who was at Umeå University in Sweden, published a paper in the journal Science entitled "A Programmable Dual RNA-Guided DNA Endonuclease in Adaptive Bacterial Immunity." Here's a clip from the podcast back in July 2012, where science writer Nell Barry and I discussed the implications of their discovery.
I love this just because of the potential of this story. And this is researchers who've been looking at bacteria and looking at how bacteria use certain molecules like molecular scissors to snip up their DNA and glue it together and helps them develop different characteristics to help them survive. But they've actually looked at these molecular scissors and found out how they work. And they think that possibly you could use this technology to make programmable scissors. So you could cut up human DNA, animal DNA, and basically glue it back together in any kind of way you like.
That's pretty cool. I mean, I think it's kind of what I think of as genetic engineering. I guess you think, oh, you'll just put together whichever bit of the DNA that you want. But actually, in reality, that's not really possible yet. So I suppose this is taking us a little bit closer to real designer genetic tailoring, or whatever you might like to call it.
So I remember when I was in the lab, and this was some time ago now, so things may have changed, but if you wanted to do genetic engineering and stick different bits of DNA together, you had to look at the sequence, and there were only certain sequences that you could cut using enzymes. Things have probably moved on now, but I think there is some restriction in the sequences that you can cut and glue together. So having a different set of technology could really be exciting.
Yeah, and I guess the sort of eventual implications of that would be that you could create these kind of designer organisms, like maybe bacteria that degrade nasty environmental toxins or produce things that we need for drugs or all kinds of exciting applications, because we know that bacteria and fungi have all these abilities, and it's just about could we harness them to do the things we want, I guess.
Watch this space, I think, because it is still very early days for that. But thank you very much. That's Nell Barry, science writer.
Let's take a closer look at exactly what's involved in CRISPR, or to give it its full name, CRISPR-Cas9. To find out more about this molecular toolkit and what it can do, I went along to a meeting organised by the Progress Educational Trust discussing new genetic techniques and the impact they could have on human health and human genomes in the future. I caught up with one of the speakers, Tony Perry from the University of Bath, who told me more about the story of CRISPR and some of its potential applications.
The prototype comes from bacteria that give you a sore throat, actually, the sore throat bacteria Streptococcus pyogenes. And it seems to be a kind of defense system. I mean, it turns out that even bugs get bugs. And so these Streptococcus pyogenes, these sore throat bacteria, themselves get invaded by viruses. And the CRISPR-Cas9 was evolved as a way of cutting the viral DNA and thereby defending themselves, the strep pyogenes, against these viral invaders.
So what are the components of this self-defense system? How does it work? And how have researchers then hacked this to do more precise editing?
The system really is like a pair of molecular scissors and a molecular sat-nav. The sat-nav is a small RNA molecule, and it guides the scissors, the molecular scissors, to precisely where you want it to go in the genome. And the reason it does that is because, like a sat-nav, it's programmable. So you get to tell the sat-nav what the coordinates are in the genome, and it will then take the scissors to that point in the genome, and the scissors will cut there. And when they do so, when the scissors do so, they make a double-stranded break called a DSB, and then the cell has got two types of toolkit that it can use to repair that double-stranded break. And one type of repair that the cell can use, or one toolkit, is a simple kind of paste mechanism.
Just get the ends and glue them back together again.
Absolutely, just get the ends, glue them back together again quickly. It does have to be a rapid process, because these breaks are anathema to cells. If they're not repaired quickly, the cell can die, and even worse, it can give rise to cancer and death of the organism in multicellular organisms. So although it's very useful for research, because you can use it to knock out genes if the cut is in a gene, it's probably not going to be so useful for clinical applications. Anyway, and the second toolkit that the cell has, or mammalian cell has, to repair a double-stranded break is called homology-directed repair. Well, we can actually add in our own designer piece of DNA, which is used for repair. And so we can design that, we can produce it, fabricate it in vitro, in the laboratory, and make sure by sequencing that it's exactly what we want. And then we can introduce it into the cell at the same time as we've introduced the molecular sat-nav and the molecular scissors, the CRISPR-Cas9. And so the cell, in the right circumstances, will use this extra piece of DNA that we've added as a repair template. And what you end up with is, in effect, this sequence that you've added, precisely inserted in the targeted position in the genome, so that it's been used to, in other words, to repair the genome, and you've introduced the change that corresponds to the DNA that you've added in.
So we've got the CRISPR, which is the RNA, the guiding system. We've got the Cas9, the scissors, and then this DNA template, and that could be anything I can imagine.
It can't quite be anything you can imagine as yet. Perhaps one day. The constraint, one constraint at the moment, is the size that you want to, if you want to introduce a piece of DNA. So you make the cut where you want the cut to be, so you can introduce that a large piece of DNA where you want it to be. But there probably is an upper limit at the moment today on how much novel DNA you could introduce. And we're probably in the many thousands of base pairs, or many thousands of characters in the genome, and we don't know how, whether the sky's the limit or not. But what we do know is that as you increase the length of information that you want to introduce, the efficiency drops. And so probably if you wanted to introduce a really large piece of DNA, for whatever reason, you might have to do that in multiple steps.
So we've got this technology, which seems like an incredibly powerful tool, and I know that scientists all over the world are using it in all kinds of ways in research in the lab to understand how genes work and how genes get turned on and off and all this kind of thing. But what we're talking about at this meeting here is editing the human genome. Tell me about the two different approaches that people are trying to think about, not doing necessarily at the moment, but the two sort of different ways that people are thinking about doing this at the moment.
So the as I see it, this whole topic can be sort of, perhaps rather artificially, but sorted into whether the changes that you make to the genome are heritable, or, in other words, they can be passed on in successive generations, or are not heritable. So the two main types of non-heritable genome editing changes that you might make and work together with existing technologies that are variously well established. So
this is effectively just normal cells of the body that are broken. You're repairing them in some way.
You can repair cells in situ using gene therapy, and this would be coupled together very nicely with CRISPR-Cas9, but you here are doing the editing, as it were, of cells in the patient, of the patient cells in situ. And there are one or two clinical trials that are already, as I understand it, in progress to use this kind of in situ approach of somatic cell gene therapy.
What sort of diseases are people starting to look at?
Well, the ones that I am aware of are, for example, retinopathies. So you can go in and you can edit genes that predispose to certain types of retinopathy.
So that's problems with eyesight at the back of the eye.
Exactly, problems with eyesight. And this is quite a good place to start because the eye is relatively accessible and a great deal is known about the eye. And so this is something which lends itself to this application of CRISPR-Cas9. So this is an example, perhaps the first of many, but it's an example of somatic cell gene therapy combined with CRISPR-Cas9. So somatic cell gene therapy at the moment there are probably over 600 clinical trials ongoing in the US, and it's a technology that's been around for some 25 years or more since the first successful somatic cell gene therapy. So we might see this with CRISPR-Cas9, which is very new, being combined with very well-established clinical technologies. The other, the second non-heritable type of application would be where you, which is a cell therapy, where you take cells from a patient who is affected with a particular genetic condition that predisposes to a disease, and you then edit those cells in vitro in the laboratory, and then you can confirm that you've made the edit that you want to make, and you can put those cells in effect, you can put them then back into the patient because they now have you've now fixed, as it were, the genetic change that predisposed to their condition. And that can happen either by taking cells and directly editing them and putting them back in. And this is largely speculative, although there are one or two ongoing pieces of work. The applications for that are, for example, where you can recover hematopoietic cells from the bone marrow of patients, and then you can potentially edit genes in these blood stem cells, and then transplant this bone marrow back into the patient so that now the patient's bone marrow cells have got the repaired version of the cells have got the repaired version of the gene, and the problem is fixed. Another way, perhaps a little bit more futuristic, is where, but it's conceivable, is combining CRISPR-Cas9 with the whole technology of induced pluripotent stem cells. So induced pluripotent stem cells were something that was discovered by a method that was reported by Shinya Yamanaka. He won the Nobel Prize in 2012 for this. And basically what you can do is you can take somatic cells like skin cells, and you can, if you do the right treatment, if you subject them to the right factors, you can cause them to start behaving like embryo-like cells. And from those embryo-like cells, you can ask them to then specialise, re-specialise, if you like, into whatever cell you ask them to specialise into. So now we have a system, if we combine this iPS cell technology, where we could, if we have a patient, perhaps a patient with a neurological disease that has a genetic predisposition, we could take skin cells from that patient, because although skin is not the brain, clearly those cells in many cases would also carry the same mutation. It's just that they're not, there's no manifestation of the mutation there because they're not neurons. But we can take skin cells, generate from them iPS cells, embryo-like cells. We could go in with CRISPR-Cas9, so combining the CRISPR-Cas9 here, fix the problem, and then ask these embryo-like cells, these iPS cells, to differentiate to become neurons, which we can do in many cases in many different cell types, and then we can transplant the neurons, which are derived in effect, it's all a bit roundabout, but they are derived from the patient, back into the patient, but now those neurons have got the fixed genome. So that's an example, another example of non-heritable, because the neuron is not the germline, so that's another example of how CRISPR-Cas9 might be used in non-heritable therapy. And this IPS, not CRISPR-Cas9, but IPS, this kind of IPS approach is being used and has been used in clinical trials, for example, in Japan.
Tony Perry from the University of Bath. And we'll be hearing more from him in next month's podcast when we take a look at whether CRISPR could be used to genetically engineer humans. And, getting to the heart of the burning questions, I ask whether my friend could hack her genome to grow a tail. You're listening to the Naked Genetics podcast with me, Kat Arney. Still to come, our gene of the month is black and white and very cuddly. But first, back in December, the US National Academies of Sciences and Medicines, the Royal Society in London and the Chinese Academy of Sciences convened a major summit in Washington to discuss the use and implications of using CRISPR for modifying human cells and embryos. The technology to do this is either in place or in progress, but just because we can doesn't mean that we should. Professor Azeem Sarani from the Gurdon Institute in Cambridge went along, and I spoke to him during a break at the Progress Educational Trust conference, where he'd been presenting his work on creating egg and sperm cells from somatic cells in the body, such as skin, to find out who went to the Washington Summit and what happened there.
Well, there were scientists and there were ethicists, there were lawyers, so it was a mixed group of people. So the scientists were putting their information on, you know, how far the technique has got and what new developments might come.
And presumably what we don't know as well and what some of the risks are.
There are risks. For example, although most of the work suggests that, you know, you don't have particular problems with off-target effects.
This is accidentally cutting things you don't want to cut.
Yeah. I think overall it looks like the incidence of off-target effects is far less than was anticipated. So that's one good thing.
In terms of the technology, we now know that there are researchers who are working on how to take cells from the body, somatic cells like skin cells, and then treat them in certain ways and even potentially turn these into egg and sperm. I mean, that's a whole world, not needing to take an egg and a sperm from a man and a woman and edit them, but actually you could just take someone's skin cells and make a baby and change those genes.
Because, you know, these are children that are not born yet, so you can't talk about informed consent, you know.
It's the kind of the playing God argument.
Yeah, and then other people say, yeah, well, when you have children naturally, you don't ask their permission, you know. You're just passing on your genes.
I didn't want to be born.
Good and bad, you know. You don't go and say, you know, I didn't get permission from the children I gave birth to or something like that, you know. So those are things that did come up at the meeting, you know, I think that the thing that was surprising to me was that I went there thinking that there'd be a lot of people who would be saying, you know, gene editing, germline gene editing is a red line, you know, we don't cross this. And I found that overall people were much more prepared to debate this, and they didn't say, you know, we should never do it. So the consensus at the end was that we should review this periodically, so they want to see how the science is progressing, what the public views are, whether the public opinion is shifting like it did with some of the other things. So I think, you know, that's a good thing, because I think, you know, we have to see. So I think at the moment the decision is that, you know, people just press on with doing basic research. So if you have, for example, a very good reason why you want to use CRISPR-Cas9 on human embryos, for example, not to implant but to understand how genes work, how cells are made and so on, then I think the general consensus is that this should be allowed. I think this could also be the case for cells that give rise to germ cells. I've already used it in the synthetic germ cells we have made, you know, to understand how genes are working.
But how important is it that this isn't just a decision that the scientists make? You know, say, okay, we understand the science, we should be the ones who decide how this works.
I think that absolutely not. I don't think the scientists are forcing this issue. I think my reading of the situation is that scientists are excited about the work they're doing because I think this is a very powerful tool. And so most of the basic researchers see this as an opportunity to gain knowledge. So that's exciting enough for them. They're not necessarily interested in pushing any kind of force this onto the public and say, you know, now we're going to decide because we can do it, we will do it. I think the overall tone of this meeting was that we will present the science and we want to inform the public, and then it has to be a decision for the public through the regulatory committees and agencies. They differ in different countries, so it's not going to be uniform. That was very clear that, you know, it's not... It may be that the regulatory framework is not going to be, you know, the same everywhere because there are different conditions and things like that. So it will very much be dependent on, you know, each country kind of taking this on. But doing it through this interaction, international interaction, so that, you know, there's a debate internationally as well.
And to return to some of the more exciting technology down the road, people are now starting to talk about making egg and sperm cells from cells in the body, potentially engineering those. How do you see that kind of technology unfolding? Is this going to be the future of this kind of technology?
I think we are, to be honest, we are far from that. I think really we've just taken the first steps. I mean, we are being able to make the very early germ cells. Also, much more complicated issue is whether they are going through proper programming. We'd have to see whether they are going through all of those kinds of changes properly in culture.
That was Professor Azeem Sarani from the Gurdon Institute in Cambridge. With all this talk of engineering the genome, it's important to remember that we really don't understand much at all about how our genes work and what they do. Every year, scientists find hundreds, if not thousands, of associations between tiny variations in our DNA and the risk of all kinds of diseases and disorders, from cancer and heart disease to diabetes and depression, through genome-wide association studies, usually known as GWAS. Unpicking exactly how these genetic variants work is a complex task, and a new paper from Susie Gage and her colleagues at Bristol University has just thrown some more complexity into the mix: the impact of genes on lifestyle factors. I asked her to explain what she's found.
The sort of rationale behind this paper is just trying to get a better handle on what the results of genome-wide association studies actually mean, what they can actually tell us, because it's all well and good knowing that certain genetic variants are associated with a disease or with a phenotype of any kind, but until you actually can sort of delve a bit deeper and work out what that association actually means, that's sort of only of limited interest, really.
So we hear these stories in the papers, you know, 10 new genes for cancer found, you know, 100 new genes for autism. Is that this kind of study that's throwing up these genes and we don't really know what they are and what they do?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, in some cases, you do know what a particular genetic variant does in terms of coding for a protein or something like that, where you can actually test it. But more often than not, actually, we don't know at the moment. And so that's sort of the question is, well, how do we know what these variants are actually doing? Is it some sort of biological effect that they're having on the disorder, on cancer, for example? Or is it actually that they are having an effect on something else, and that something else might be having the effect on cancer?
So unpack that a bit. What do you mean by that? What sort of examples would apply here?
The reason that we became interested in this is that we noticed that this genetic variant that is quite robustly associated with how heavy a smoker you are if you're a smoker. This genetic variant was actually seen in a genome-wide association study of lung cancer. So that could mean that there's just some sort of shared genetic architecture. So this gene might have an effect on both smoking and your risk of lung cancer. But what seems far more parsimonious explanation of this is actually that the reason that this genotype or this genetic variant is coming out of the lung cancer GWAS is because smoking causes lung cancer. So genetic variants that predict smoking are going to be seen in GWASs of lung cancer.
Basically, if someone has this genetic variation and they are a smoker, they're going to want to smoke loads. And that's
exactly
what's going to be more likely to give them lung cancer.
And that increases their risk of lung cancer. It, absolutely, yes.
So are there any other genetic variations that might be working in a similar way?
Quite possibly, yes. At the moment, the sort of main thing holding us back is actually we don't know the specific genotypes that are associated with these kind of modifiable exposures. There's a good example in the alcohol literature. There's a genetic variant that quite strongly predicts alcohol consumption, and it's not very common in European populations, but a bit more common in samples of East Asian ancestry. If you look in these populations, then genome-wide association studies of high blood pressure identify this particular alcohol-related genotype, but it's not seen in GWASs of high blood pressure in European populations, which is pretty strong, or certainly fairly strong evidence that it might be alcohol causing high blood pressure. And that's why you only see this particular genotype in these GWASs in these specific populations.
And so do you think that there might be other ones out there? We've done cigarettes and alcohol. Any other vices that might be linked to conditions?
Well, absolutely. Quite a lot of substance use is known to be heritable. So, for example, cannabis use. But as yet, we haven't identified the specific genetic variants that are associated with cannabis use. But as and when these variants are identified, it would be perfectly plausible that we might see these genetic variants coming out of GWASs for diseases if there is a causal link between cannabis and schizophrenia, and we identify these cannabis sort of risk increasing genetic variants, then if there's truly a causal association between cannabis and schizophrenia, you might well expect that these genetic variants would come out in GWASs of schizophrenia.
So what do we do with this information? I always find it interesting with these genetic studies, whether you sort of say, oh, well, you've got the gene variation that makes you more likely to be a stoner. Well, what do we do? Or, you know, you're going to smoke more, so bad luck. Where do we take this work?
So in terms of what these studies might actually tell us, when we're looking at genome-wide association studies of diseases, if a genetic variant comes out of one of these studies, that's actually telling us that there's a modifiable risk factor that's increasing the risk of this disease, then that's a much easier place to target an intervention at than a biological mechanism.
So it's easier to help someone stop smoking, say, than it is to find and develop a drug that targets a molecular pathway that might reduce their lung cancer risk.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah.
But don't we already know that people should give up smoking?
Well, I mean, that is a very good point. I think being able to sort of say a bit more definitively that what we're seeing are causal associations here can only help in terms of getting that message across.
There's also a lot of talk about the nature versus nurture or nature with nurture. And I guess what you're unpicking here is how our genes interact with the things that we do, the things in our lifestyle. It feels like this is really first steps into that world, that we still don't really understand much about how our lifestyle and our environment affects our genes and what happens to us.
Yeah, I think that's the key point here, that we have to be very cautious when we kind of interpret these studies, because we're really just at the very beginning of being able to understand what these genetic associations might actually mean and how we can then harness them to improve people's health and to improve our own understanding of humans, our behaviour and our health.
Bristol University's Susie Gage, and her paper was published this week in the journal PLOS Genetics. And finally, it's time for our gene of the month, and this time it's the cute and cuddly panda. Rather than being a gene in these famous black and white bears, panda is found in sea urchins, and it's short for paracentrotus antinodal dorsal activity. It encodes a molecule that's important for helping a developing sea urchin embryo tell its front side from its back, known as dorsoventral patterning, and is laid down in the sea urchin egg before it's even fertilised. PANDA works by acting against another important developmental molecule called nodal, which tells cells in the developing urchin to become ventral, the front bit, rather than dorsal, that's the back. That's all for now. Next month, I'll be continuing with a look at CRISPR, finding out if we can use the technology to genetically modify humans and discovering how researchers are using it to figure out how genes work in sickness and in health. If you've got any questions or feedback, just email me at genetics@thenakedscientist.com. You can also get in touch through the main Naked Scientist Facebook page or by tweeting at Naked Genetics. Every episode of the Naked Genetics podcast is on iTunes and online at nakedscientist.com/genetics. The Naked Genetics podcast is brought to you in association with the Genetics Society, online at genetics.org.uk. I'll see you next time for another peek inside your genes.